This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. On this second-to-last day of voting in the November 2020 general election, we'll hear from candidates running for San Luis Obispo City Council.
Since that parking structure was approved last November, 4% of California has burned, and we have had 120-degree temperature reading at Cal Poly. I mean, that's not Cal Poly, that's Death Valley. We have to get serious about climate change.
Also, we'll learn more about the El Moro Elfin Forest.
Because of the very poor sandy soil and the winds that come in and shear the tops, they never grow more than about 10, 15 feet high.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 2nd, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. As of Sunday night, 63% of San Luis Obispo County voters have already cast their ballot in the current election. But of those still deciding or planning to head to the polls tomorrow, some will be weighing in on who will fill two open seats on the San Luis Obispo City Council. Just under 31,000 people in San Luis Obispo are voting in that race. KCBX News spoke with most of those candidates, asking each the same questions. Two of the candidates, Jeffrey Specht and Eric Long, did not respond to KCBX's request for an interview or comment. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart with more.
KCBX News asked the SLO City Council candidates three main questions. One, what do you think is the city's most pressing need at this time and what should be done about it? Two, what actions, if any, would you advocate for as an elected city council member to help the community and businesses recover from the COVID-19 shutdown? And three, do you support the city's recent efforts towards decarbonization, the city's clean energy choice program, why or why not? Going in alphabetical order, candidate Kelly Evans says she thinks the city's most pressing need at this time is
our tendency to treat issues as singular. I've done a lot of thinking about this question, and there are people who will tell you that the most pressing need is COVID recovery, absolutely, and how that affects our economy. And you can start to talk about that for a couple minutes before it becomes a housing issue, before it becomes an infrastructure issue, before it becomes about sustainability. Most of the things that we need to be addressed need to be done through a lens of sustainability, through a lens of regional collaboration, through a lens of how it affects our diversity, through a lens of what it means for our economic recovery. And it's much more affordable to be addressing things as multi-pronged issues that affect each other, as opposed to solving one thing and then having to apply that solution to the other five things that you didn't think it applied to. And in a time where the government is going to be needing to reduce its budget quite significantly, it's important to make sure that we're making the most well-thought-out, affordable decisions to keep as many programs from being cut as possible.
Jan Marks says,
as we've seen locally and nationwide, electing inexperienced people with extreme ideas can have unintended consequences. During this unprecedented time of COVID, economic and educational collapse, climate change and civil unrest, the city needs to elect leaders with a proven track record to guide us to a positive, sustainable, and equitable post-pandemic future.
Candidate James Papp says,
clearly the most pressing need is dealing with COVID and dealing with the economic fallout of COVID. But COVID has exacerbated problems that we already had. Problems of homelessness, problems of affordable housing, problems of dying local retail. So those were things that needed already to be solved, and COVID has just made them worse.
Andy Pease says,
our most pressing need is economic recovery, and investing in that recovery provides the opportunity to address the long-term issues of climate crisis and economic disparity. We can focus on green jobs, improving the regional jobs housing balance, addressing the public health emergency of racism, and providing environmental protection for open space and carbon sequestration.
SLO City Council candidate Abriana Torres says,
I believe that the escalating homelessness in SLO is one of the most pressing issues. We have to divert focus to homeless services that can assist the community members living on the street get back to self-sufficiency. The issue of homelessness is so complex. There are the people who want to and have the capability to get better, but then there's also drug abuse, mental health issues, which respectively require in-depth resources. I've been evaluating what other communities are doing, what's proven to be successful in helping out homeless populations, and as well as talking to programs that have been implemented in order to see what the best solution for San Luis Obispo is going to be. I know for sure that it's not something the city can solve on their own. It's something that we all have to come together to be a part of, city, community members, private entities. It's going to take a village.
And finally, candidate Robin Wolf says,
I think our city's most pressing need at this time is our recovery from the effects of COVID-19 on our health and our economy. There is no larger issue, no issue that touches our lives more directly than our recovery. It's an umbrella issue for me that encompasses many other important issues like health, safety, housing, civil unrest, and our homeless population. I believe we need to focus all of our city's efforts towards supporting our residents in this time of recovery.
Again, in alphabetical order, asked what actions should be taken to recover from the pandemic, Kelly Evans says,
I think, first of all, treating it as if we are in the recovery stage is not something we're ready for. Our county is still, we've leveled out a little bit, but August was our worst month in terms of cases, in terms of death rate. It was not something that was happening in March here. And so making sure that we're being aware of that before we talk about recovery, that we're still really living through it, and we need to make sure that our community is getting through this before we can start recovering from it, is incredibly important. In terms of our businesses specifically, I would really like to work with the Downtown Association to focus on how to create virtual events so that our community members can still be participating in normal life and socializing like they used to be able to, but without having to do it in person and without endangering servers, essentially. I think that would also help businesses if they could have a couple focused days where they knew they were going to get really high levels of business. They wouldn't necessarily have to be staffed and open on other days when it was going to be a little bit lighter and they were losing money.
Jan Mark says,
well, the first thing is getting the COVID-19 virus under control. And I'm in favor of mandatory mask wearing in public places, including the streets of San Luis Obispo. And we're a charter city. San Luis Obispo's got the authority to make mask wearing a requirement. But for some reason, so far, our council has been somewhat reluctant to do that. And I have to say that the only way that the economy and the educational system is going to get back on track is if we can curb that virus. I also want to say that the city needs to do everything that we possibly can to protect ourselves from blackouts. And that means looking into microgrids and increasing the storage capacity of residents citywide, so that we are able to, if we have to, continue conducting business with the internet. And if we need air conditioning, we need to make sure that the grid doesn't go down. So I also would work with the community to update the economic development strategic plan, which is sadly out of date. We need to take another look at that.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Greta March is asking questions of San Luis Obispo City Council candidates Kelly Evans, Jan Marks, James Papp, Andrea Pease, Brianna Torres, and Robin Wolf.
James Papp says,
well, the first thing is we need to be serious about preventing spread. And the science has been clear since early May to mask up. And the city council has just refused to tell people that that is a mandate, and they've refused to do enforcement. And we enforce every other law that we have on the books. And if we deal with the virus, then we can deal with people disappearing from the economy. But the other thing is that we do need to do more than outdoor dining. And the only reason outdoor dining happened so fast is the city has been talking about that literally for 45 years, almost half a century. So we need to outdoor other activities. We certainly need to outdoor the arts. and our culture, because if we don't do that, those institutions are going to disappear forever and will have to be rebuilt in the future in some form. And that means outdoor exhibitions, outdoor performances, and appreciating our architecture as a resource, our historic architecture as a resource, rather than tearing it down to build banal buildings. So we can be an outdoor tourist attraction, and we can have an outdoor activity for our people who sorely need it. Outdoor activities have always taken place in San Luis Obispo, but we need initiative from the city to say, our culture is in danger of disappearing, and we need to do something about that. We need to take that initiative and work together with cultural institutions.
Andrea Pease replied,
the pandemic has been devastating for so many businesses, and we just need to focus on economic recovery. Thankfully, back in 2017, we gradually tightened our city budget by almost $9 million. So we planned for long-term fiscal health, and that puts us in a stronger position now for recovery. After those COVID restrictions were put in place, we launched Open Slow with parklets and streamlined permitting and small grants. I'll continue this work to retain local businesses while we still support head of household jobs, help address childcare for working families, and maintain essential services for all our residents.
Abriana Torres says,
COVID-19 is an invisible threat, but we've learned that if we take certain precautions, we can help protect ourselves and others. It's through education that we'll be able to empower our residents to make informed decisions on how to navigate this safely. And the same goes for local businesses. Instead of dictating who must close, we should be informing business owners on how they can safely stay open. And it'll never make sense to me that we were able to keep shopping at the big box stores where large crowds of people were allowed while we were forcing the mom and pops to remain closed. If we'd given all businesses an opportunity to make necessary modifications to remain open safely sooner, we could have mitigated the economic devastation that we are seeing now. And moving forward, I will continue to be an advocate for hardworking residents and business owners. We have to keep regulations at a minimum, keep burdensome fees at a minimum. I was really happy to see the tenant improvement program that the city rolled out, and it's going to be important to continue to be proactive in creating programs that support our businesses.
And candidate Robin Wolf replied,
as a member of SLO City Council, I would advocate for the meeting of minds to help our community and businesses recover from our COVID-19 shutdown. I think we need to access information and viewpoints and perspectives from across our leading industries, from business owners, private organizations, nonprofits, volunteer groups, as well as city and public organizations. I think it will take the experience of all to rise the tide that raises all ships.
And finally, we asked the candidates if they support the city's recent efforts towards decarbonization, the city's clean energy choice program, Why or Why Not. In response, Kelly Evans says,
I do support it. I think that it was done in a really, really balanced way. I am a renter whose stove and oven are entirely gas powered. And so if they had insisted that everything be retrofitted to be carbon neutral, that would be incredibly expensive and difficult for folks like me. So I think how they did it was really very realistic and a good move towards the carbon neutrality that we claim we want and that we really need to work for.
Jan Marks replied,
yes, I am a strong supporter of the Clean Energy Choice Program. It's for new buildings, and I think that's important. This is a logical extension and implementation of the city's climate action plan. I spearheaded the first one in the year 2012. I'm glad it's been updated, and on council, I will definitely continue to press for its implementation. I have to say that I've been an environmentalist all my adult life and have been an activist against climate change for decades. And climate change is really the biggest threat that's facing not just humanity, but the whole planet. And I know this wasn't a controversial kind of decision, And I think that it's important to listen to residents when they have concerns and be flexible as much as we can be and still meet our decarbonization goals, which are so important.
Candidate James Papp says,
Yes, I do. But so the nature of a weak mayor system is that most of the power lies in our city manager. The city council has oversight. The result is that the city council wants to show it's doing something, so they tend to pass symbolic measures. The city declared a car-free, carbon-neutral future and immediately approved a 400-space parking garage. The cognitive dissonance there is astounding. You cannot be car-free and carbon-neutral and be building parking structures. And since that parking structure was approved, which I vociferously opposed last November, 4% of California has burned, and we have had a 120-degree temperature reading at Cal Poly. I mean, that's not Cal Poly, that's Death Valley. We have to get serious about climate change and not just do, you know, the bougie little symbolic gestures that make us feel good.
Incumbent City Council member Andy Pease says,
I do support the Clean Energy Choice Program. Building all electric and avoiding the costs of natural gas piping is cost effective and is popular with homebuyers who are concerned about indoor air quality. Locally, we are all seeing the effects of climate change and the high heat and the drought and fires. We must do our part to reduce carbon emissions. The Clean Energy Choice Program is one important way to help get us there.
Candidate Abriana Torres says,
I support decarbonization. However, I do not support the Clean Energy Choice for new buildings for the following reasons. First of all, electric isn't necessarily cleaner if we're using natural gas to produce our electricity. We don't yet have the infrastructure in place to support all electric without using natural gas. Currently, our grid uses 45% natural gas to produce our electricity. The gas company is looking at renewable natural gas options. Second, it will create a monopoly, which will limit competition and eliminates the least expensive source of energy we use, thereby increasing the cost of living. Lower income households will bear the largest burden of higher energy costs.
And finally, candidate Robin Wolf replied,
I absolutely support the city's recent efforts towards decarbonization. Our city has committed to a clean energy choice program and carbon neutrality by 2035. I think that we have all recently been witness to the devastating effects of climate change on our area, specifically in California and throughout the world. We've faced inordinate amounts of wildfires, smoke warnings, raising temperatures, all while trying to recover from a virus that has affected us economically as well as health-wise. I think that every sector must do its part to reduce our carbon footprint and to come up with creative solutions towards working for a better future.
That was San Luis Obispo City Council candidates Kelly Evans, Jan Marks, James Papp, Andrea Pease, Brianna Torres, and Robin Wolf answering questions posed by the KCBX newsroom. Two of the candidates, Jeffrey Specht and Eric Long, did not respond to KCBX's request for an interview or comment. As in several Central Coast cities this election, Pismo Beach residents are deciding on their next mayor, two or more city council seats, and a tax measure. KCBX contributor Beth Thornton has more on the mayor's race.
There are two candidates on the ballot for Pismo Beach mayor, incumbent Ed Woge and challenger Dan Shadwell. Woge is seeking his third term as mayor, having first been elected in 2016. In Pismo Beach, the mayor's term is only 2 years. Prior to becoming mayor, Woge served for 8 years on the city council.
I'm very collaborative and collegial on the council. We welcome public comments. I welcome diverse opinions. And it's my job as mayor to try to see where there's agreement on moving forward on an issue and guide the council toward a decision.
He says he's made significant progress fixing up the city and has a record of getting things done, like the new Pier Plaza.
One of the major efforts was to fix up the downtown, and we've done that. We've also almost completed the Shell Beach streetscape, which provides a safe route to schools and underground utilities.
Wogie says he's seeking re-election because there is still more to do. In addition to continued progress on pandemic recovery, he says a new fire station is a top priority.
We definitely need a new station, and this new station will provide a much better response time, which means our firefighters will get to where they need to go much quicker.
Dan Shadwell is challenging Wogie, saying it's time for a change. Shadwell says local government is about listening to constituents, and he was encouraged to run by community members who felt their issues weren't being addressed.
Listen to the residents, listen to our city staff, and come up with good solutions to a lot of the problems that have just been kicked down the road for a long time. Those include traffic and parking shortages, trash on the beaches.
Shadwell has a background in journalism and now works in real estate. He has not held public office before, but says his experience in small business, as well as his skills as a journalist, prepare him well for the job of mayor.
Each day, you typically go through a drill where you reach out to the smartest people you can find who are the best authorities in that particular field, and you quiz them and try to learn as much as you can, distill the information.
His priorities, if elected, include COVID-19 response, safety issues, and traffic solutions.
We can begin to move folks out of their cars and make the whole area a much more pedestrian-friendly, much more environmentally conscious area.
Both candidates have local endorsements, which you can find on their websites. Reporting for KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
And just a note that mayoral candidate Dan Shadwell is married to KCBX reporter Angel Russell. As for the one local measure Pismo Beach residents will see on their ballots, it's a bed tax, meaning if passed, tourists staying in Pismo Beach hotels, motels, and vacation rentals will pay an extra 1% on their bill. Measure B20 is expected to raise an extra $1 million a year to help the city pay for things like road repairs and pier upkeep. In contrast, Morro Bay is asking its voters to approve a 1% sales tax, an increase paid by both tourists and residents alike. There's only one referendum on this year's ballot, Proposition 25, which will determine whether California bans cash bail. Cap Radio's Scott Rodd has this report.
To understand Prop 25, you have to go back to 2018. Lawmakers voted to abolish the state's cash bail system, giving judges more control over defendants' pretrial release. They'd rely on computerized risk assessments to make their decision. The bail industry swiftly filed a referendum. Now it's up to voters to decide. John Bouters is with the nonprofit Californians for Safety and Justice, a reform group that supports Prop 25, meaning they want to end cash bail.
The cash bail industry is a multi-billion dollar industry that has preyed off of low-income and working families, and particularly communities of color, for a very long time.
He adds that cash bail can result in defendants confessing to crimes they did not commit. Cap Radio had no luck requesting interviews with the No on Prop 25 campaign or prosecutors and victims' rights groups that also oppose the measure. They argue more defendants on the street could endanger communities. But there's also opposition from some criminal justice reform groups that say Prop 25 does not go far enough. John Raefling is a senior researcher with Human Rights Watch. He says it's problematic that a defendant's release would be based on employment history, education level, and past criminal record.
Because the factors that they're using reflect racial and class bias within our society overall, the risk assessment tools, they're unavoidably discriminatory.
Supporters warn that defeating Prop 25 means the legislature can't pass another law abolishing cash bail. Opponents like Raefling say that's not true. Lawmakers can't pass the exact same law, but they can pursue bail reforms that go further. I'm Scott Rodd.
Working Lunch is a Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona and a community member. Today, we'll hear from Kim Bishop from the Cal Poly Journalism Department.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the SLO Chamber's weekly series where we get to sit down with leaders in our community and help us connect with our fellow community members. It hopefully allows us to bring back some of that connection we've been missing during these challenging times and maybe get to learn some new things about people we interact with or maybe have never met before. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today you're going to be a part of my conversation with journalism professor and author Kim Bishop. Before joining Cal Poly, Kim worked with the LA Times and Outside Magazine. was a freelancer, authored an award-winning book, and chaired the journalism department at Cuesta College. Kim, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Jim. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Obviously, you have an interest in journalism that you've made a career of. Did that start out as the plan? Were you always there? Or what sparked your interest for journalism?
So honestly, when I was in middle school, I found out that if I signed up for a journalism class, they'd let me get out of taking home ec. So I got into journalism to get out of home ec. I still don't really know how to sew, but I have no regrets. I just, from that moment on, I thought it was so much fun. I couldn't imagine why anybody wouldn't want to do it. And so I just kind of stayed the course from there.
So was there a writer or an anchor that you idolized or a particular story that drew you in to flourish that passion?
Sure. I loved the whole process. And, you know, I grew up watching the evening news with my family after dinner. And I was really drawn to all of those anchors. You know, I have a family member who used to host Meet the Press in the 70s. And so, you know, journalism as a profession was always kind of mythologized in our family. And so it just felt like a natural fit.
What was your first job in the industry?
I had lots of little internships, you know, with my hometown paper, where I covered the Ventura County Fair, lemon juice drinking contest. That was my first story that actually landed on the front page of the Camarillo Daily News. And I worked for my college paper, but really my first kind of job, I decided to apply for an internship at the LA Times at the Ventura Bureau. And I was feeling pretty confident about things. I walked in with my clips from high school and the local paper and college and showed my resume to the bureau chief. And he leaned across the desk and said, "Kimberly, you don't just walk into the Los Angeles Times and start reporting." And I was devastated and embarrassed. And I walked back out and the receptionist who I had started chatting with while I was waiting for my interview said, you know, asked me how it went. And I told her, and she said, "Well, I just got permission to hire an administrative intern. So why don't you come work for me?" And so I did. And I would type in birth announcements and death notices, and I would file old papers in the morgue. That was the first 30 minutes of my job. And I would just twiddle my thumbs. So it took me about a week to work up the courage to walk over to the city desk and introduce myself and ask if I could help. And the city editor didn't know what kind of intern I was and just handed me a stack of press releases and said, "Can you write some briefs?" Sure. And I found out what briefs were and started writing. And that eventually led to a job in the newsroom.
There's a great story in there. Don't just do what you're handed. Go out there and go get, if you want to do something, go out and get it. That's awesome.
That's right. That's right. It turns out that sometimes you can just walk into the Los Angeles Times and start reporting. Who knew?
Journalism is one of those ways that you get connected to all of it. And over the past few years, there's been seemingly endless criticisms of journalism and journalists with the proclamation that the industry's imminent demise, that it's not going to survive all this. So we know all the problems, and I don't want to spend a lot of time kind of rehashing that. I'm hoping maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the solutions that are emerging and that, you know, what does the long term kind of look like?
Yeah, I actually am feeling more optimistic about the industry than I have in a long time. I think we've passed the bottom, I hope. I feel like there's this realization that maybe the assumption we've had for a while now that information should be free is not the best way to find out about the world. And so I feel confident that that consumers are going to start investing in quality information. There's a lot happening in the business models realm. There's an organization called Lion. It's a group of independent online news organizations. They're coming up with great ways to exist. NewsHawk in Santa Barbara is one of them, and they're one of the few organizations that has been hiring consistently. There's a ton in the media innovation and entrepreneurship world. Even locally, I teach a class on that subject. We're introducing journalism students to these entrepreneurship concepts and just entrepreneurial thinking, where you can identify your community and identify problems in that community and then innovate around solutions. And I've just been so impressed and inspired by what the students are coming up with. You know, there was a group that actually was working with Snapchat to use their geolocation technology to deliver micro-targeted news to students on campus. that's cool. And it's something I certainly never would have thought of. There's another group that came up with a very short news podcast that's directed to college students that they can consume while they're walking from class to class. That actually went to the hatchery where you know, they're getting help developing that and turning it into a real world thing. And the other thing I'm really hopeful about, there's this trend towards something called solutions journalism. You know, a lot of people turn away from news because it just feels so heavy all the time. And there is, you know, that it's fact that a big fire is news. The absence of a fire isn't necessarily news. But solutions journalism is kind of a Mr. Rogers-like approach to that problem. You know, you want to find the helpers and see what they're doing. Who are the people who are working on these problems and what stories can we tell about them?
And you touched on something there that I think is really sad in our time. It's the idea that we are consuming TikTok, Twitter's bite-sized information is all we can kind of take in. You know, are people really going to dig in? Because some of these subjects cannot be fully vetted or discussed in that short form. Is that a thing we're just going to have to live with? Or do you see a balance somewhere between long form, short form kind of reporting?
There's been some great long form reporting that's still happening. But I do think there's this tendency that we have now to consume information in bite-sized chunks. I'm certainly guilty of that myself. Like if I'm reading something longer than a tweet, then I feel myself start to get impatient. But I think, you know, it's important for us to create that mindset where we're just going to relax into a piece of journalism and get beyond the headline for lots of reasons and just sit with it and appreciate the literature and appreciate the narrative and appreciate the depth of understanding that only comes from those long form pieces.
When you're getting quality products, yeah, you should be paying for it. And obviously people are trying to keep people informed during COVID. And so they're giving away some of this for free. Do you see any potential problems of building a pay for scale and potentially ending up with just echo chambers all kind of over the place as like you buy the one that tells you the thing you want to hear?
Yeah, that's a big problem. I mean, in olden times when we were consuming news, there were just a few choices, right? And we all read the same newspaper that landed on our driveway and we listened to the same, you know, news network shows. I think that a few winners are still going to emerge, especially in that local news space. We all know where to get reliable information. We just don't all choose to pay for that reliable information. I think that's where we need to start, just with this understanding that, you know, good reporting, good journalism costs some money. And if we're willing to throw a couple lattes worth of our funds at as trusted news source every month, then we'll be able to continue to get that information.
Yeah, it's definitely along those lines, you know, where we apply some of those things. If we want to see fair trade chocolate, if we want to see fair trade clothing and textiles and things that it's going to cost us, you know, pay our worker, farm workers in the field to do the, you know, pay them a living wage to pull all of our fruit and our vegetables. For the journalists to be able to survive, we've got to be able to pay it.
Right. Unfortunately, it's a self-perpetuating problem. The less funding our newsrooms get, the fewer reporters they have covering the community. And, you know, it's not that those reporters are working overtime and doing a fantastic job, but there's only so much you can do when you've got one person who's somehow supposed to be covering government in the entire county and maybe education too. Like, that's just not sustainable. That's too much to ask of any one individual. We need to build our newsrooms back to what they once were.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we see a lot of folks, you know, locally, potentially, well, why aren't they covering these things? And to your point exactly is that, well, we've got to make the business model work so that they can hire people to cover multiple sections. Because that's what it used to happen, right? When your first experience the LA Times, there were tons of people covering different things, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There would be one person on the crime beat, and that's all they were doing. You know, several people covering education in the county. Several people covering government. You know, you feasibly could go to every city council meeting and supervisors meeting and not just the ones that you know there's a well-known contentious issue coming up.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between Kim Bischoff of the Cal Poly Journalism Department. She's speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce.
Trust is the big issue right now. We're seeing a crisis of trust, not just in our news institutions, but in all of our institutions. You know, people just simply have lost trust. The problem that's particular to the news industry is that there were some early missteps that further eroded that trust. This notion that we need to create headlines that get people to click on a story, that turned out to be a really bad idea. It may get you some increased traffic in the beginning, in the short term, but then when people start to feel like they're being tricked or like the headline doesn't accurately reflect what's in the story, then they stop clicking. So I think we're seeing a little bit of a realization, not across the board, but you know, there's a big news company that's talking about paying its reporters based on traffic, which is a step backwards. But there is this this growing realization that that we need to practice radical transparency with our readers. So it's about writing headlines that accurately reflect the content of the story. And it's about letting readers in on the process of creating the news. So it was always something that kind of happened behind closed doors. You know, we would deliver the news product to you and there was no participation, public participation in how that product was made. So one of the things we're doing around trust is showing our work. I'm constantly telling my students now, show your work. Where did you get that that piece of information that you just shared? It's not enough to have a fact statement in your story. You need to link to the primary document that that fact statement came from so that everyone can retrace your steps. You see individual journalists more active on social media these days, and part of that is driven by this quest for transparency. We want to let the public in on the process of reporting so that when they see that final product, they know how they got there.
Is it the idea to build trust over those other articles that aren't that huge level so that when you say an anonymous source, it fits?
Yeah, absolutely. Like there's this misconception about anonymous sources. They're never anonymous to the reporter. They're only anonymous to the reader. But you have to have built that trust relationship with your audience before you start citing anonymous sources. If you don't have that trust relationship, you're going to have a hard time with, you know, how that information is received by the public.
Journalism obviously is a key to understanding, you know, making local policy and understanding as a resident, as a citizen. When you're teaching your class, do you talk about why good journalism is so important for good local policy?
For sure. Good local policy starts with an engaged electorate. If we're not keeping our community members informed of what's happening at every level of government, then they're going to have a really hard time making decisions based on factual information. And unfortunately, you know, disinformation loves a vacuum. And when there's a shortage of accurate information that's getting out to the public, then it is very quickly backfilled with rumor. And that's not good for anybody or any community. You know, years ago when I first moved here, I went to one of the budget planning meetings that happens every 2 years. I didn't even know that was a thing, but a friend had invited me. And it was the meeting where a bunch of kids showed up and they wanted to ask city council to prioritize the skate park. And I remember just watching like kid after kid after kid speak at the microphone. And so many people who were in the room were moved by their words. And sure enough, they showed up in numbers and engaged in the process. And city council prioritized that skate park that now exists. And that was really transformative for me. It made me feel like, oh, we as community members do have a say. Government isn't something that's imposed on us. It's something that we can actively participate in. And so I kind of got hooked on that and never let go.
When you went to then, I assume that kind of got you linked into serving on the city planning commission. And digging into the depths of land use. Did you think that helped? And would you encourage more people to serve on some of these advisory bodies?
Absolutely. There's no better way to get a crash course in whatever subject you're talking about on an advisory committee than to serve on that advisory committee. Our city staff is really wonderful. And there's a teaching element in their job where they will take all of us newbies who volunteer for committees, and they will help us translate staff reports into language that we understand. I wish every citizen could go through that education process. It gives you such a great window into how communities work and how decisions are made. And how, when, you know, after decisions are made by our elected officials, how they're actually implemented. It's fascinating. And I definitely recommend that at some point, everyone who cares about an issue in the city, whether it's, you know, transportation or housing or anything, the place to start is on one of those advisory bodies, because you get a real education.
You get to see the difficult decisions that have to be made every day when you sit up there. Decisions you have to make are not easy. There's a give and take and a pro and a con to all of them, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. There were definitely nights when I'd wake up at 2 a.m. thinking, oh, that was not the right decision. I loved the homework, but the stress around the, you know, making that decision and taking all of the information we have and synthesizing it and trying to hear all the voices, it's not easy.
And getting involved in the city, what do you see?
You know, I'm really excited about the fact that, you know, San Luis Obispo is really good at creating opportunities for citizens to engage in the process, whether they're able to physically go to meetings or not. But I don't think our culture has caught up with that yet. I think, you know, a lot of us feel like government is something that other people participate in and don't even know how to get involved. So my hope is that I'll get to work on some sort of new solution to the civic engagement problem, and you know, maybe work with the city to getting more community members aware and involved in all the ways that they can participate.
So let's do a hypothetical. If you weren't in journalism and teaching, what type of work do you think you'd be doing right now?
Oh gosh, comedy writing. I mean, who doesn't want to write for Comedy Central, right? Political speech writing, funny political speeches, I guess, would be roller derby star. I did think about going back to school to study city and regional planning, because it's just fascinating to me to see who actually gets the stuff done in our communities. And, you know, these decisions are handed down to planners and they actually figure out how to make them happen. So that's a fascinating career option for me in my next life.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It was really fun talking with you, Jim.
That was a conversation between Kim Bishop of the Cal Poly Journalism Department speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. And finally, on this week's nonprofit story, KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes introduces us to Skip Rothstein, the conservation and board chair of the nonprofit Friends of El Morro Elfin Forest. The Elfin Forest natural area is about 90 acres in Los Osos on the southeastern shore of Morro Bay. And the name Elfin Forest comes from the short stature of the California live oaks.
So, Skip, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let's start off by telling the listeners a little bit more about the El Morro Elfin Forest and why it's called an elfin forest.
The El Morro Elfin Forest, for those of you that haven't visited it yet, is in Los Osos. The El Morro Elfin Forest is actually on the edge of the water. It's a oak forest and coastal scrub area, and it's one of the last pristine areas that is left. It's immediately next door to Los Osos, and it was saved by community members as recently as 30 years ago from development.
I think there's a program called SWAP. I wonder if that's what was instrumental in saving that area.
The name SWAP means Small Wilderness Area Preservation. And this is a group that was formed with Ansel Adams on the board about 50 years ago. And some local residents led by a woman named Yolanda Waddell, the name is known at KCBX.
Right.
Yolanda got together community members and worked with the county to raise money and negotiate with the landowner. And this 90-acre parcel was saved as a nature preserve, and that was about 30 years ago now. And the organization SWAP subsequently became, just recently, Friends of El Morro Elfin Forest. So that's the history of the organization. It is a 501(c). It's run entirely by volunteers, and the land itself was donated to the county. So it is a county park, and it is maintained by the volunteer organization.
So let's talk a bit about how maintenance happens, because you also mentioned that you are the conservation chairman of the forest. How does that happen, Skip? How do you conserve the forest and maintain it?
Okay. 30 years ago, the forest area was badly run down in the sense that the community was enjoying it. They were driving cars on it and hiking through it, but they were also doing all sorts of things over the years to just trails were going hither and yon. And there was a real problem with erosion in the park. And it had a tremendous number of invasive plants that were making headway in the park. So one of the things that the group did was raise quite a bit of money to build a boardwalk, a mile loop through the park. And a boardwalk keeps people, for the most part, from just going any old way. At the same time, many fences were built to fence off eroded areas, and projects of weeding, systematic weeding of invasive grasses like veldgrass were launched, and those have been carried out now for the last 30 years.
So it's a matter of getting people away from the vegetation in order to preserve that, it sounds like.
Exactly.
How are you actually able to find the boardwalks and then explore this area?
If you drive into Los Osos, any one of the numbered streets off South Bay Boulevard from 17 all the way down to 11th, at the end of the street, each street, the county has put a sign that says Elfin Forest. And sometimes visitors come down and say, why are all the streets named Elfin Forest? Well, if you look on the other side, it says 17th, 16th, and so on. But if you go to the end of the street, there is usually a sand trail that leads about 100 yards to the Elfin Forest boardwalk. The boardwalk is a mile loop that goes essentially almost from South Bay Boulevard all the way down to 11th. As you walk along the loop, you have views of the bay. There are two beautiful outlooks, which we call Bush Lupin Point and Sienna's View. And from those points, you can not only see the bay, you can see a great deal of the forest, and you can see even some of the morros from that point.
So what about now today? We are in a period of sheltering because of COVID. I know you've done some guided tours. Are you still doing guided tours, and are people still able to gather in the area?
Well, we have suspended most of the tours, although some of the walks are now scheduled. And I believe the plan is to have no more than six people at a time. If they indicate an interest in the tour, they can look at our website, which is elfin-forest.org. Contact us with the information on the website.
And are there any restrictions? I think it does say on there you need to have your face masks and probably distancing.
It'd be a good idea to have face masks. The Elfin Forest is well used, and if you go there, especially on a weekend, you'll find people. And since it's a mile long, you can have a lot of people with proper distancing.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Contributor Consuelo Mewkes is speaking with Skip Rothstein of the Friends of El Morro Elfin Forest.
Also, I noticed something on the website about vegetation trimmings. Are you still doing that type of thing?
Yeah, the work that we do, initially there was a lot of restoration. There was actually planting being done by the now Friends of the Elfin Forest. We did a tremendous amount of weeding over the years of taking away invasive plants. And as I said, this veldgrass is one of the main ones. Now we do maintain the weeding, as we have been very successful in enabling the shrub to be restored. What's happening, the shrubs grow over the boardwalk at times. So one of the things we do beside maintaining the boardwalk, making sure the screws are in the wood and all that sort of thing, is trim along the boardwalk. The Elfin Forest is known for Pacific oaks that grow in about one third of the forest. They're elfin in the sense that because of the very poor sandy soil and the winds that come in and shear the tops, they never grow more than about 10, 15 feet high. But they're genetically the same as the oaks that grow a half a mile away that might grow up to 25 to 50 feet. So we do, you asked the question about trimming. We do trim, but only along the trails, just to keep them open.
You've also answered a question of why it's called the Elfin Forest. When you take a look at the oaks that grow just down the road, and they're so much taller.
Yeah, probably the main reason is that the Elfin Forest is on an ancient sand dune, the whole Elfin Forest, and the bay sands are very nutrient poor. So they're a little starved for food, as you might say. And the other aspect is that it's believed that the wind shear, that the constant winds that come in off the bay, tend to keep them trimmed at the top. It's arguable how much of this wind shear thing is important. Probably the nutrient factor is the greatest thing that causes them to be dwarfed.
So this really is something different for people in the area and outside of the area to come and visit and see. So with that in mind and all of the rest, are there any particular environmental concerns right now that you have with this area?
Yeah. There are two endangered species that are of great concern. One is the Moro sideband snail. It's a small snail. It's threatened by the ordinary garden snails, which can be found in every backyard in Morro Bay. So the snail is limited in its range, extremely limited in its range, to the scrub that is in the Morro Bay area and south to Montana de Oro. It has many sister species, but it's unique in that it's only found in this very limited Morro Bay, Montana de Oro area. The other recognized endangered species is the Morro Bay manzanita. It also has a very limited range. Now, it looks almost the same as the manzanitas that grow up and down the California coast. There are slight genetic differences in the manzanitas as you go from one area to another along our coast. So the Morro Bay manzanita, again, has such a limited range, primarily because so much of the area has been taken over by development. One of the key areas that it lives in is in this small 90-acre forested area.
So is it clearly marked? Like if you're walking there, would it be marked that this is the manzanita, you can see it? Or would you be able to, even with the snails, be able to actually see some of them gathered?
If you look at our trail guide, you'll probably find the manzanita because there's a marker on the side of the trail. But most people in our area are familiar one way or another with manzanita. So when you see a manzanita in the Elfin Forest, and it's in many places along the trail, you should have no trouble in recognizing it. It's a large plant. The snail, on the other hand, is down in the weeds, so to speak. Most visitors never are even aware the snail is there. They're very small. They're about half the size of a garden snail. They are of such concern that when we are weeding, we are required by the Federal Department of Fish and Wildlife to have a snail monitor present. And the snail monitor's duty is
first before we weed is to go around and poke around in the weeds and see if any snails are there. If there are, we can't weed. If a snail is found while we are working, the snail monitor must be called. The snail monitor, it comes over, picks up the snail gently and moves it to a safe area. And the snail monitor is supposed to write a report and send it into Fish and Wildlife. It's rather remarkable. Just as a side note, when the sewers were placed, were just recently built in the Los Osos area, the whole area is part of the snail area. So snail monitors were present. That procedure had to be used.
That is so interesting. Is this a reason why there has been limited development in that area also, and you were able to get it set aside?
No.
Oh.
No. The problem is that development has not been so limited. However, when the community group SWAP went out and worked for getting grants, I'm sure that was one consideration, that it was a valuable piece of property, as you put it. So I'm sure made mention of that in the grants.
There was something on the website about reporting sightings. If somebody was in the area and they saw a sighting of something different, they could report it. Tell us just briefly about that.
What we have is a great deal of wildlife. The wildlife consists of large mammals. We have deer, we have raccoons, we have the gray fox, which is the native fox, which is one of the animals that's being threatened by the invasive species from the east, like the red fox. But we do have the gray fox. We have possums, which, by the way, are a invasive animal, but they're nativized to this area now. We have occasionally wild turkey. But the real problem that we have, and we keep an eye out for them, are invasive wild pigs. Oh. And within the last 2 years, we had quite an incursion of wild pigs in the area. They eat the oak seeds and the acorns and the seedlings. So we do have quite a mammal population. We also have an extensive bird population. We're on the flyway for migrating birds. And each year, the big sit where bird watchers occupy usually one of the outlooks and spend a day, a couple of days counting birds. And this is one of the leading spots literally in the world for species of birds that can be observed within a day or so. We have the ocean-going birds, shoreline birds, the oak forest birds from here with binoculars. You can see even some of the mountain birds on the morrows.
Would you please tell people how to find your website?
elfin-forest.org.
And I have been speaking with Skip Rothstein of the El Morro Elfin Forest. Thank you so much. This is the Nonprofit Story.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.